Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, May 20th, 2013. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on the first and third Monday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24/7 on prn.fm and drsaputo.com.
Today we'll be talking about what's new in the news in health, and you'll hear Vicki's 2020 tips at 20 after and 20 of the hour. And we've got a great show for you today that's going to include, how did healthcare die and become a business?
And our SSRI antidepressants safe after surgery.
Can naturopaths reduce cardiovascular risk factors in patients already seeing a cardiologist?
And do drug companies give kickbacks to doctors and pharmacies for prescribing their drugs? If so, we should give them a kick.
Right back. You're right. And can 1 8-week course of the relaxation response, Herbert Benson's work from Harvard, change the DNA that regulates inflammation, energy metabolism, and insulin secretion?
We have a lot of dissatisfaction with our healthcare system, and it's not new that the World Health Organization only ranks the U.S. 37th in the world and 19th among industrialized countries in the overall quality of our healthcare. Now, in spite of all our sophisticated technology, this is how we're ranked. We have an epidemic of chronic disease and 1 million deaths per year from medical complications. So we need to do something soon. And what we thought would be a good place to start would be to go over the history of healthcare so as to better understand how this happened.
I mean, what happened? We're looking at a system, you know, in the days of Marcus Welby and Ben Casey and Dr. Kildare. Remember those days, Vicki?
Oh, yeah.
I think a lot of our listeners don't remember it because it was a long time ago. But would they have worked for an HMO? And how were they different?
Well, they were making house calls with their little black bags.
They'd come and they'd take a chicken or a turkey or whatever it is that you could give them for the services, and they'd spend time with you, and there was a lot of concern. You were in the front of their mind all the time. It was really care that was personalized.
So how did we get from healing to science and technology? How did we get to Dr. House?
Well, see, Dr. House now is another story. He's sort of like the combination of the old Dr. Kildare and Dr. Welby, but he's also got the high-tech stuff, too. And what I like about him is that he really spends time and thinks about things as well. He thinks about the whole person. But he's not really what we see in HMO medicine today, because time is money. And there isn't a lot of time to spend with people. And the problem is that healthcare is no longer just a service where there's great concern and care for your patient.
It's a business.
It's become a terrible business that has a lot of downside to it because of that.
So we were going to start out by talking about how we got to where we are now and how this all happened with healthcare. So let's start with when there was a price freeze on wages.
In World War II, okay, that there was a reason to have a wage freeze. And so the government made it illegal for corporations or businesses to increase wages. And in that setting, the way they got around it was to give people benefits. And one of the benefits they got were healthcare benefits. Now, that's different from insurance. Insurance is something that you have for what you can't afford to pay for. But a benefit is something you expect to use, and so it could be translated into dollars. And so wages would be increased, and of course it defeated what the government was trying to do. But here we are with a system that started getting people used to the idea of, if you get sick, why not go see a doctor? Because that doctor may just be able to help you.
Well, it didn't used to be, I don't think, that people would go see a doctor when they had a cold.
Or any other minor thing, because it costs a lot of money.
But
if you had the benefit already,
you
expect to deserve the service because you've paid for it.
So it's entitlement. People felt that they were entitled to it.
That's the best word that I could think of to use what actually happened. So everything changed at that point, and it created a medical insurance industry that's become a vulture now. And what we have is a lot of manufactured business for profit. We now consume nearly 18% of the gross national product. That comes to almost $2.8 trillion a year on health care that's being led by the pharmaceutical industry and the insurance industry.
So big business is really being funded by we the people?
Somebody's got to pay
for
it.
Out of our pockets.
Exactly. We would have been better off had we not had this overdependence, this medicalization of health care, which has happened over the last 60 or so years.
So in other words, the health insurance companies have been manufacturing a lot of business, which costs more money.
Absolutely.
And the more profits being created by these illnesses, like, for example, they say things like osteopenia, which is like...
Exactly.
It's not osteoporosis.
No, it's actually normal. It's on the lower end of normal, but they've medicalized it and called it a disease.
And the same thing with pre-hypertension.
Sure, or pre-obesity, or pre-anything, because the idea is...
Pre-diabetes.
Yeah. See, the more money that's spent on health care, the more... that people make off of it, because say we make up a percentage of what the healthcare expenses are. If healthcare expenses were $1 million a year, then we would only make about 20% of that in profit, so we'd make $200,000. But if it was $20 billion a year, all of a sudden the number gets bigger.
So
and if it's $20 trillion a year, it's even bigger. And when you start talking about numbers that are like that, you're talking about an enormous amount of money, and it's the money that drives the system, not the care.
Well, and it means more money for big pharma, for the pharmaceutical companies.
More money for everybody.
Yeah.
So but who pays for it? The people that are getting, quotes, the service. But it's really not designed to give you the best service there is. It's designed to try and treat the symptoms you have without really getting you well, because if you were well, nobody'd make any money and the business would collapse, and so would the economy of this country, because it's 18% of everything we spend in the U.S. is on healthcare.
Gee. Well, did the MDs not wanting to be involved with healthcare finances contribute to this? I mean, they gave the business their businesses to the health insurance companies and the HMOs mm-hmm. back in the 80s and 90s, I guess.
I remember when this happened, and I was thinking, something's wrong with this system, because we can't really avoid taking responsibility for the cost of healthcare, because if we give away the financial purse strings of medicine, we're giving away the power that runs it, because it's the
dollars.
The doctors
were coming from fear.
Well, they didn't want to be bothered with finances. Look, we're doctors. We went to medical school. We help people. Not going to be worried about how much a drug costs or how much a technology costs. If my patient needs something, I'm going to give that person the service that they need. I remember thinking that way myself. And then it dawned on me that if we wound up giving away the financial purse strings, that we'd be in a place where somebody else would be saying, well, doctor, there isn't enough money for that procedure. We're not going to be able to do it. And my outrage wasn't going to be enough to change their mind.
So the doctors end up being employees.
Wound up joining HMOs. Why? Because the cost of health care was skyrocketing. It was getting to a place where the insurance companies weren't able to make the money that they felt entitled to make, because it was just people couldn't afford it. And so when that cost got very high, then what happened is large conglomerates got together. The hospitals bought practices. The health maintenance organizations, the HMOs, bought practices. We see organizations like Kaiser Permanente owning the doctors.
So they bought the doctors out for, what, $200,000-$300,000?
Yeah, $200,000-$400,000 per practice.
And they said, don't worry, we'll take over your practice. You don't have to worry with the business of it.
Well, I think doctors were in fear that if they didn't move with these low-cost insurance programs, that people weren't going to pay out of pocket. And the insurance companies that were charging enormous amounts of money for the best care that you could get were just too expensive for people. So the doctors panicked. And there was a big rush to join HMOs and any other organization that could provide you with patients.
I remember you and one other doctor were the only ones that held out in our area.
Well, he's not held out any longer now. He's under the guise of a huge system that is controlling what he can do to a significant extent. So if you go along with the program and that's okay with you, then go ahead. But the problem that started all this was our refusal to participate in managing healthcare costs, because the cost of all the technology and the industry is enormous when you start looking at some of the things we can do. I mean, you look at the amount of technology there is in the hospitals today. It's mind-boggling. We can do things that are unbelievable, but they cost money. Now, should we be spending half of all of our healthcare dollars in the last year of life on old people or people that are so far gone that you know they're going to die to try and recover a little bit of time, maybe, or maybe to provide them with a little less discomfort? All these things are contrary to what the thinking of a doctor is. We do not want to be bothered with those kinds of issues. But unless we step up to the plate and take that kind of responsibility...
Corporate America has the power and control.
You've got it. Now, if a doctor wants to do something and it's going to be expensive, all kinds of things happen. Insurance companies are liable to do what's called rescission. Okay, so if you have been with an insurance company for 20 years, you've paid your dues, and you've been a very good person business-wise, and then you get breast cancer, they send you a little note that says, we're canceling your policy for reasons that are very, very tenuous. And you are stuck. They just say, go ahead, sue us.
Well, I thought Obamacare was going to take care of that.
Well, Obamacare is a step in the right direction there. I mean, it's already illegal to do, but they do it anyway and say, go ahead, sue me.
Uh-huh.
But they've got billions of dollars to defend, and you've got thousands of dollars maybe to spend, so it's not right. And that's what's happened.
Well, the other thing is that this isn't really a healthcare system. What we have is a sick care system,
that's right.
It's sick.
Well, it is.
I mean, it makes more money, but the medical doctors are treating symptoms more than they do the cause.
Yeah, we treat people with a bag of tools to treat a set of symptoms rather than being with our patients and listening to them and finding out how they feel and what they want and considering their illness in a way that includes their whole life story.
Well,
that's what Dr. Kildare and Dr. Welby did, you know, when we were talking about
yes,
them.
Yes, right.
That's what was so attractive to them. They were so connected and interested, and at all costs, the patient was the honored part of the relationship.
Well, now what it seems like what we have is that the best health care is for the rich, and the worst is for the poor and the Medicaid patients.
Well, that's right.
Middle class
patients,
right. Too.
That's what's happened, because what we've done is we've created a system where there are disparities now that are huge. Why do you think the World Health Organization ranks us 37th in the world? I mean, what would be the reason for that? So that's a good question that we need to look at carefully, because what's happened is we've got the best healthcare system, the best tools that we can possibly have to treat diseases, but they're not available to the bulk of people here. You can't take a Medicaid patient where there's very little money and start doing expensive technologies to them, because the money's just not there.
Well, the medical care now with the new system that we have with Obamacare, it's become diluted. So there's more people to take care of with less.
With less money. That's right. Because when there are more people, I mean, they're expensive. And you're talking about bringing in 37 more million people into a system that's already inadequate. What do you think is going to happen? There won't be enough doctors. There's not going to be enough money. The care is not going to be that available. And we're going to sink to below 37. In fact, we're at the bottom of all industrialized countries. We spend twice as much. We're now spending about $15,000 a year for the best insurance that you can get for a family of four.
And
That's not affordable.
And we need to move from the sick care system to a health care system.
Right.
Where we teach wellness and prevention.
Exactly.
And a healthy lifestyle.
Well, that's what's going to happen what's going to have to happen if we're going to be able to afford health care. We could cut the cost of healthcare by 80 to 90%, in my opinion, if people just didn't get sick. And that makes common sense. If you're not sick, you shouldn't have to spend the money.
But then the healthcare system doesn't make profit.
Well, so what you're seeing is a whole ship that's wounded, that's going down a river off the edge of Niagara Falls. And what you're going to see is the bloodsuckers draining the life out of what's on that ship until it crashes on the rocks below. And then they're going to wonder, what went wrong? Why can't we continue to suck the life out of all this? That's what's happened. We can't let that continue like that, but we don't have the power to stop it. The government.
Well, eventually everybody's going to get sick and die anyway. I mean, that's part of the life cycle.
Well, you may just wear out slowly. I mean, that's different than getting a heart attack or a stroke or, you know, some other problem that's going to make you miserable while you're dying.
Getting sick from all these chronic diseases and medical complications.
Well, that's right. And they're not necessary. We know what makes people sick and we know how to prevent it, but we're not using all that science to our advantage. And if we don't do that, then we're going to continue the system just like it is. So now you know the story of what happened. What can you do? I say a lot, because the buck stops in your lap. Take care of yourself. Live a healthy lifestyle. Eat right. Reduce your stress. Exercise every day. Don't be overweight. Don't expose yourself to toxic exposures, and have a purpose in your life. And guess what? You might just be happy, and you might live a life that's really comfortable. That's the answer. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. It's time for Nurse Vicki's first 2020 tip on why is vitamin F important? Vitamin F? What the heck is that? And then we'll be back talking about our SSRI antidepressants safe after surgery.
Hi, I'm Dr. Len Saputo, and I'd like to introduce you to drsaputo.com, which is the web's most unique and evolutionary resource for good health and self-empowerment. DrSaputo.com offers a library of more than 2,000 audio and video files featuring me and my wife, registered nurse Vicki Saputo, with cutting-edge integrative and holistic health information. Our media files also include an impressive array of leading health and wellness experts.
Taking the health assessments on DrSaputo.com will provide you with customized integrative information about your unique health issues with specific ideas about how to safely and effectively manage them.
This website offers free membership as a service to inspire and educate, honoring you and your privacy while you're taking responsibility for your health.
DrSaputo.com offers entertaining and informative fast-track videos every weekday morning on what's new in healthcare, so you can cut through the confusion.
Visit DrSaputo.com and take your free health assessment now. That's DrSaputo.com.
What's vitamin F? Well, vitamin F is for friends, because spending time with
that's
friends.
That's really cool. I didn't know it was a vitamin. I guess you don't always make it yourself, huh?
Well, spending time with friends is healthy.
Absolutely.
Have you ever asked yourself, why do I have a variety of friends who are all so different in character?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, how is it possible that I can get along with them all? I think that each friend helps to bring out a different part of me. With one of them, I'm polite. With another one, I joke. I can sit down and talk about serious matters with one. With another, I laugh a lot. I listen to one friend's problems, then I listen to another one's advice for me. My friends are like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. And when completed, they form a treasure box, a treasure of friends. They're my friends who understand me better than I understand myself.
Sometimes that's right.
They're friends who support me through good days and bad days. And real age doctors tell us that friends are good for our health. Dr. Oz calls them vitamin F for friends and counts the benefits of friends as essential for our well-being. Now, research shows that people in strong social circles have less risk of depression and terminal strokes. And if you enjoy vitamin F constantly, you can be up to 30 years younger than your real age. The warmth of friendship stops stress. And even in your most intense moments, it decreases the chance of a cardiac arrest or a stroke by 50%. So I'm so happy that I have a stock of vitamin F. We should value our friends and keep in touch with them. We should try to see the funny side of things and laugh together and pray for each other in the tough moments. The love of a good friend is always there. Now, if they're not local, they're a phone call away or a Skype call away or an email away. Friends, we need to keep in touch with them, and they're better than antidepressants.
I'll say.
They're part of a healthy lifestyle.
Absolutely. It's really comforting to have somebody like you. You can go to when there's a problem and just share things that are challenging and get advice and comfort.
Well, I do walks and talks.
I do, too.
I have a lot of friends that I take walks with.
You do it more regularly. I just do it occasionally.
Yeah, I do it several times a week, but it's great, you know, because it's plenty of time to talk about stuff. How often do you have time to just sit and talk on the phone to somebody like that?
Well, that's right.
Anyway, we have yet another reason to avoid the SSRI antidepressants Prozac and Paxil and Zoloft and Celexa, the designer drugs that many people are dependent on. And they have now been linked to increased risks after surgery associated mostly with bleeding that require transfusions and hospital readmissions and even death when taken near surgery. So the scientists looked at over 530,000 patient records. And what did they find?
Right. They published their results in the journal Internal Medicine in April of this year. And what they found was that there was an increase in hospital mortality of 20%. I'm talking about small numbers here. Bleeding complications, 9%. And 30-day readmission rates were up 22%, all just for taking SSRI antidepressants. And that doesn't mean people who are just started on them during the hospitalization. These are people who had been on it for a long time.
So it seems like they interfere with platelet function.
Absolutely. The platelets don't get sticky. They don't clump. They can't cause clotting to occur. And you just had a surgical procedure where bleeding is a big issue. What would you expect?
Maybe before we go further, we should define what an SSRI antidepressant is and what's the difference between that and some of the other antidepressants like the SNRI depressants.
Okay, well, we can spend a minute on that. The SSRI stand for selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. That's why we call them SSRIs, because it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to people that don't understand the physiology, the electrophysiology of a nerve.
Well, most people know that serotonin is the feel-good hormone.
Absolutely. And levels in depression are often low. And so what doctors or what the pharmaceutical companies came up with the idea of is let's increase the level of serotonin and see if people feel better. And so what they did is they give people these drugs like you just mentioned. And what they do is they block one nerve that leads to another nerve has a nerve ending that joins to the other nerve, and it releases serotonin in the brain. Now, if you can block the receptor sites with something that will keep the serotonin from being reabsorbed on the other side,
so that it goes higher.
Yeah, the levels go up and you feel better. And so in theory, it sounds like a really good thing.
So what happens with these other antidepressants like Zyban, Cymbalta, Effexor, Wellbutrin that are considered SNRIs?
Well, these work more on norepinephrine, and they block the uptake of norepinephrine. And that, too, is supposed to be mood elevating. But when you look at the SSRI antidepressants and the myriad of studies that have been published, for mild to moderate depression, SSRIs do no more than a placebo does.
Exercise or
does
being
better
with a friend.
Yes, your friend would be the most valuable for sure. And of course, nobody's done a study on that because that's just supposed to be common sense.
Yeah, we've talked about them in the past. Mm-hmm. They have.
Oh, friends can do that. Uh-huh. Well, see, we look at about 8 neurotransmitter systems of the probably 2,000 or 3,000 that exist. And think we understand biochemistry of the brain. That's just ludicrous. And that's why what we have is the pharmaceutical companies who are making these drugs and making billions and billions of dollars every year off of them continue to promote them and tell us that that's something that we should be prescribing for our patients. But when you look at the review studies that have been done on that, for mild to moderate depression, it is the same as taking a placebo pill. So why in the world would we do something to just to use drugs like that have all these potential side effects that we see?
Well, the other thing, too, is it doesn't solve the problems. It might make people feel a little bit better, but it doesn't solve the problems.
No, it never solves the problems.
And they're especially dangerous to take with things like aspirin or nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs.
Well, that's right, because they can interfere with the action of that. But more importantly, we're looking at the side effects
of the
drugs. Well, bleeding is one, but nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, insomnia, impotence, an increased risk for suicide or becoming manic, or causing other kinds of problems if you're taking other drugs, like if you're taking Coumadin or Digitalis or important heart drugs that are used to regulate rhythm, or taking other kinds of antidepressants like the tricyclics, which include Elavil.
And if you have a death from, I mean, it can increase the risk of death from a heart attack 200%.
Yeah, right. I mean, we're looking at drugs. If the placebo does the same thing, why in the world are we doing the pills? I mean, talk about an ad system that's worked to get doctors confused and patients confused. Here's the example.
The other thing that I think is ironic is many times doctors prescribe them to women that are pregnant.
Bad idea.
And that actually makes it more difficult to get pregnant, increases the risk of miscarriage and autism. There's a whole list of things that it does. We also in the past talked about how it increases the risk of dying in the intensive care unit by 73%. SSRIs increase the risk of breast and ovarian cancer. I mean, all of these things that we're talking about right here are enough to cause you to be depressed.
Well, that's right. And here we have our psychiatrist now moving to become psychopharmacologist. To me, that's just absurd. And everybody's buying into it. Why? Because of the power of the pharmaceutical industry. They have more money than anybody, and they sponsor 2/3 of the research that's done in this country. And let me tell you, the medical centers thrive and depend on that money from Big Pharma to be able to exist, because that's where they get the money to do the work that they do to train new doctors and to take care of people.
Okay, so here's another example of where a pharmaceutical drug may not work well with a nutritional supplement. Because,
well, that's right.
Like, for example, if it's going to be causing bleeding, you don't want to be taking fish oil or krill oil or flaxseed oil or ginkgo biloba or even vitamin E or natokinase with it.
Well, that's probably right. You have to be very careful if you do.
And there
An
are
experienced
other things
you practitioner would know how to do that, but I would agree with you. Those are things that we need to pay attention to, and most doctors don't even know that. And when we don't know much about what's going on in situations like that, we don't know how to give the best advice. And that's something.
This is why it's good for people to learn these things themselves.
Well, that's right. Okay, it's time for a network station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. And when we come back, we'll be talking about, can naturopaths reduce cardiovascular risk factors in patients seeing a cardiologist? So stay tuned for more Prescriptions for Health Radio. Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki.
And here's a study where physicians seem to be taking credit for the ways that naturopathic doctors reduce cardiovascular risk factors. Now, first of all, metabolic syndrome is a risk factor for heart disease, and the naturopaths reduce the prevalence of metabolic syndrome along with usual medical care by 17% over a year. So what does this really mean? I mean, how did they work the study so that the doctors ended up taking credit for teaching their patients a healthy lifestyle and the importance of nutrition?
Yeah, see, this is one of the things about medicine that's always been bizarre to me. We talk about wellness and prevention and exercise and sleep and stress reduction and all that business, but yet what do? We've got drugs for all those things. We're not really talking about lifestyle, but we take credit for it. And so what these authors did is say, well, the naturopaths are doing better, yes, indeed, but they're just doing the practice of good medicine. Well, fine. If we did the practice of good medicine as doctors, we wouldn't need the naturopaths to show us up.
But I thought what was also interesting in this article was that they talked about what the naturopaths did, but when they said that the doctors were treating the patients with an enhanced usual care, they didn't define what enhanced usual care is.
Well,
and I would think that it's probably drugs and technology.
Yeah, well, of course. I mean, that's the main thing. And I mean, every doctor knows that lifestyle is important. There's no question about that. We know it's true. We just don't do anything about it. We're barraged by direct-to-consumer ads, just like regular people are.
So if you have high blood pressure, instead of the doctor telling the patient to exercise, would they give him a drug?
Yeah.
Instead of What else?
Yes. I mean, when you read all the articles that are written by the big groups that manage hypertension, they always say diet, exercise, stress reduction, sleep. They mention all those things. Lifestyle's important. If that doesn't work, then you move to this. But how well are we trained in lifestyle measures? Not well at all. How well are the naturopaths trained? Very well. And that's why this article, it was published in the April 2013 issue of the Canadian Medical Association Journal, showed what it did. They looked at 246 postal workers, and of those 246 that entered the study, 207 finished. And what they did is they looked at what naturopaths did. They helped them with weight loss, with exercise, with supplements like essential fatty acids, the omega-3s, with fiber, coenzyme Q10, and a variety of herbs and other supplements that support heart function. So to me, it's ludicrous that we start ragging on the naturopaths, saying, well, they're just doing what a good doctor would do. Because if that was true, then it would all be done.
Okay, what they mostly focused on here was about metabolic syndrome or syndrome X. So let's quickly define what that is.
All right, these are people that are fat around the middle. They have hypertension. They have high levels of insulin. And those high levels of insulin convert sugar into fat. And then they lock it in the fat cell so it can't come out very well. And it increases our cholesterol and triglycerides, and we have a low HDL to go with it, which is also bad news. This combination of findings is associated with a much higher risk for type 2 diabetes, for hypertension, for heart attacks, for strokes, and other cardiovascular problems.
The other thing that I thought was interesting was that the study only showed Western medicine alone or with a naturopath.
Right.
I want to know where the study is without the Western medicine and only the naturopath.
Well, then you'd have to read the naturopathic literature, and it shows that they do very well.
But see, the medical profession tries to avoid that, like they do with immunizations and things like that, where they think that it's not safe to not use their system. They just make that assumption.
Well, and they're actually not experts. Doctors are not experts in lifestyle medicine any more than they are in immunizations. What they do is they follow the recommendations of the CDC for just about everything, and then they listen to the drug reps that come to their office and try to push drugs and say, hey, doc, this will work just fine. But a lot of the time you're looking at what? A doctor that's overweight, maybe a doctor that's smoking, maybe a doctor that has health problems that he or she are not taking care of. I mean, we are not healthy people in general. We don't live as long. We have a higher rate of use of drugs and alcohol and of suicide. The naturopaths, on the other hand, really have an idea of what health care is about, real health care. I mean, doctors are great at sick care, at disease care. Put somebody in a hospital, okay, who's had a heart attack or a stroke or some other major event. We're great at managing that the best that we can. The naturopaths aren't good at that. In fact, one of the faults that they have is they don't know enough about acute medicine because they don't have that experience. But they should be exposed to it. We should have naturopaths in the hospital. They would be wonderful in our hospitals doing the things that they do best that doctors are supposed to know about but don't.
Well, today's medicine is more about sick care, and the naturopaths focus more on wellness and prevention.
Yeah, well, you know, the Hippocratic Oath, the first thing it says is first, do no harm. Now, the naturopaths take that oath too, but they actually worship it and follow it. And what they're good at is keeping people well and keeping them from getting sick. And what we're going to see is a huge shift in how medicine is practiced. We can't sustain what we do because the costs of what we do are skyrocketing to the point where it's taking up 18% of every dollar that we take in this country in the form of taxes. It's 18% of the gross national product.
Can you quickly define what a naturopath is?
Sure. These are people who do wellness medicine, and they manage the treatment of diseases using natural approaches to therapy. So they're more apt to be like orthomolecular doctors. They're interested in using natural substances to support the return of normal function. So they don't get so much into the problems that doctors do with all the complications that we see from medications, from surgeries, and some of the technologies we do. It's a great thing to walk hand in hand with a naturopath. They should be all over the place. That's why I took such an active role in helping them get licensed back in 2004 when I worked with California Citizens for Health to license them, and I feel the same way today. Okay, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on how toxic is your lipstick. And when we come back, we'll be talking about, do drug companies give kickbacks to doctors and pharmacies for prescribing their drugs? Oh my gosh. And can just 1 8-week course of the relaxation response change the DNA expression of inflammation, energy metabolism, and insulin secretion? We'll be right back.
Personal skincare products can be dangerous to our health. And UC Berkeley recently did an analysis of lipstick and lip gloss of 32 common brands that are found in drugstores and department stores. And they detected lead, cadmium, chromium, aluminum, and 5 other metals at levels that could actually raise potential health concerns. Now, the toxic metals are levels that could have an effect in the long term. And when you think about it, 60% of what we put on our skin is absorbed into our bloodstream. And if you use a patch, for example, like a hormone patch, birth control patch, nitroglycerin, nicotine, think of how those are absorbed into our bloodstream.
They're actually absorbed 10 times as well across the skin as they are across the gut if you swallowed it. It's hard to believe, but true.
And lipstick and lip gloss are of special concern when they're not being blotted on tissue or left as a kiss because they're ingested or absorbed. Well, think about the person that you're kissing, too.
That's right.
But, you know, the average person eats or consumes 1.5 up to 8 tubes of lipstick in their lifetime.
Wow.
And they contain lead and other metals and mineral oil and artificial colors and chemicals and phthalates and fragrances. And some of them even have mercury as a preservative.
Wow.
And these toxins bioaccumulate and they're stored in our breasts, our fat, our organs, our bones.
Our brains.
That's yes, right. In our brains. And some of them cause cancer, neurological problems, reproductive problems, liver, kidney, respiratory problems, skin irritations, and the list goes on. So daily intakes of these lipsticks and the lip glosses can result in excessive exposure to the chromium, which is a carcinogen that's linked to stomach cancer, and it can result in potential overexposure to aluminum, cadmium, and manganese as well. And high concentrations of manganese have been linked to toxicity in the nervous system. Now, lead, especially the red lipstick like Revlon, for example, is especially a concern for young children that like to play with makeup. And
no, for sure.
Because it's really no level of lead exposure is safe for them. And like you said, lead can lead to brain defects. And remember when it was in paint and it was in gasoline? And some of the products that you can really find it in that are in the red lipstick are the L'Oreal, the Revlon, and the CoverGirl.
Jeez, the ones that are the most prestigious, huh?
Yeah, that do these walks for
right.
Breast cancer.
Walking for cancer. Yeah. Maybe it's to get it.
So we want the Cosmetics Act, which is an opportunity to regulate cosmetics, and we want this to go into effect so that the companies will be transparent about the ingredients. And this includes fragrances, which are especially important to people that are sensitive or allergic. We don't want to purchase products that have secret ingredients. And we want to get safety assessments. We need to phase out the chemicals that cause the cancer and the reproductive harm. And remember that some of the ingredients make dioxins and formaldehyde. And what's happening with these cosmetic companies is that they're selling toxic dreams. There's no safety regulation by the FDA because they don't have any authority. There's a group that's called the CIR, which is the Cosmetic Ingredient Review. And they're made up of the companies that manufacture the cosmetics. And
well, there's 11, the fox guarding the hen house.
So they only screen like about 11% for the short term for safety. So 89% aren't at all. And none of them are being tested for long-term safety. And remember, they can cause cancer, infertility, hormone problems, neurological problems, and so forth. You know, when you put a little here and a little there, it adds up. And, for example, they say that the average person puts on about 20 products a day. And that would be like at least 230 ingredients that can be hormone disruptors and carcinogens.
Right, that's every day.
And 15 different fragrances. Now, you might think, oh, this is silly. How I don't put on that many things. But think about it. There's soap, there's shampoo, cream rinse, deodorant, toothpaste, mouthwash, lotion, perfume, shaving cream, sunscreens, makeup, moisturizers, hairspray, hair gel, nail polish, makeup remover, body powder, aftershave, hand sanitizers, the whole thing. And the chemicals don't have to be on the labels. Well, what I'd recommend is going to safecosmetics.org and watching this, a 7-minute little short video by Annie Leonard called The Story of Cosmetics, because she says it so well and it's very entertaining.
Do you have a reference to that on our site at drsaputo.com?
Yeah, I have it on Vicky's Corner.
You have a lot of stuff
under
on
my
Vicky's
Safe
Corner.
Cosmetics list.
All free, by the way, on drsaputo.com. Just go there and go to Vicky's Corner, and all this information that she's telling you about, plus a ton more about a whole bunch of household cleaning agents and cosmetics and skincare products, is there for your use.
So here we go again with doctors getting kickbacks from the pharmaceutical companies for prescribing their drugs. Well, this time the culprit is Novartis. Now, normally the pharmaceutical industry is supported by the FDA, but this time the FDA has been forced to discipline Novartis due to its out-of-control bribing of doctors. And the U.S. government is suing Novartis for $65 million in kickbacks to doctors for prescribing their drugs.
That's sort of like a pittance, Vicky. When you look at the billions of dollars that they make, this is like 20 cents to somebody that's got, you know, $100.
So what are some of the drugs that Novartis is being sued for?
Well, there's a bunch of them, and most of the drugs that they're being sued for are not ones that are terribly popular, as you might have guessed, because why? They want to promote them and sell them. So drugs like Lotril, which you probably never heard of, has got two antihypertensive drugs in it. One's a calcium channel blocker and another an ACE inhibitor. And Valterna, another one that's got two things in it, an ACE inhibitor and a diuretic. And then Starlix is another one that's a way to increase insulin production in people who have diabetes. Or the drug called Myfortic, which is an immunosuppressant. All of these drugs that are not big sellers, they can make big sellers by just telling doctors and the pharmacists that if they'll push those drugs, that they'll give them a percent back. And that's what happens.
Well, something that I think is really unethical, I mean, this is just terrible, is that how they got caught for inducing pharmacies to switch to their kidney drug in exchange for kickbacks that were disguised as rebates and discounts. They just flat out lied.
Look,
and the
smart
consumer doesn't have any idea. They think, oh, this is a good deal.
Yeah, my pharmacist recommends it, or my doctor recommends it. It's the same thing with chemotherapy. I mean, look at what happens there. I mean, the price of chemotherapy is outrageous.
And many times these huge amounts of money where people end up going bankrupt and having to sell their homes and everything really only extends a person's life for like a few weeks or a couple of months.
A lot of the time that's
true. And they're miserable during that whole period of time.
Look at what happened to the people who were selling Procrit, Epogen, and Aranesp. These are three drugs that do what? They increase your blood count when you have a low blood count from either kidney disease or from cancer. And that's fine that we use those when they're appropriate. But the problem is that here's an example. One group of oncologists, of six oncologists in the Pacific Northwest, in 1 year made $2.9 million in rebates for just recommending these three drugs for their patients.
This to me sounds like this is criminal.
Yeah, that comes to $400,000 almost per doctor per year for that drug. You can imagine how much they made with all the other drugs, and that's just the sale of them.
And if you knew this ahead of time, could you trust your doctor?
Well, it happens, and you shouldn't. It depends on the setting, because not all doctors will do that. Some of them can't do it. I mean, the ones that work for the medical centers cannot do it. That goes to where? That goes to the university, to the medical center. They take it instead.
But there are rules against some of these types of things. And
oh, sure.
There are fines if they're caught, but the companies think it's worth it to get, even if they're caught, because they still are making more money than what the fine is.
Oh, I mean, the doctors got a total of, those doctors got a total of $3 million, but they may have made the company $10 million. So it's a good business deal, but it just reminds you of what's going on. This is a business.
And a
this
lot
is not
of these...
trying to pick just what's right for the patient, because in fact what happened with those drugs is they got overprescribed. And is that dangerous? Yes, it is. Because why? It caused clots, blood clots, and it caused an increased risk for heart attacks. So when somebody was on the borderline side of should I use it or not use it, the old cash register sign goes up in the brain in the back, and it's like, well, maybe it's not a bad idea. Well, maybe it is a bad idea.
Well, you know how I get emails frequently from people telling me how Obama and Michelle spent all this money taking a trip and for the plane and the dinner, and they go on and on about all the details. Well, the pharmaceutical companies have a lot of improper programs that remind me of that, because there was one where they took a group of doctors to Hooters, and they've taken some of them. They listed some of the restaurants in other countries where they spent $10,000 for a dinner.
It's just for three or four people.
What do they eat for $10,000? I have no idea how you could spend $10,000
at
a dinner.
Well, they obviously didn't spend $10,000 on the dinner, but they may have picked up a little cash on the side.
Well, and maybe they got fancy caviar and wine. And
well, I think they're, you won't, I'm sure that's
true.
Maybe
they give them drugs. But it increases the cost of our health care, including our Medicare and our Medicaid, when they're spending all this kind of money. They've got to make up for it somewhere.
Well, they're making plenty of money, Vicki. I'm not going to feel sorry for them for not making enough money. What I think they're short on is ethics, and that's what happens when you are treating or you're treating something as a business instead of a service. That's the problem.
Okay, so, you know, it's not new that relaxation reduces stress, and it's also not new that we can change our DNA with lifestyle. And if you put this all together, voila! A new study shows that we can change our DNA with only 30 minutes of relaxation. It sounds like a good idea to incorporate relaxation into our healthy lifestyle.
For sure. I mean, you're talking here about Herbert Benson's work. He's the Harvard doctor, the internist there, who came up with this about 40 years ago. And what does it do? It's really the opposite of the fight or flight response. It's the opposite of that sympathetic response that occurs naturally when we're under stress. And it relieves stress when you do this relaxation response. So your heart rate comes down, your blood pressure comes down, your oxygen consumption is better, your brain activity is lower. And we've known for a long time that the long-term practice of this relaxation response that Herbert Benson came out with changes the genetic expression on stress, and it changes our immune system, ATP production, and even insulin sensitivity, all really important things.
So you might ask, well, how do I get this deep rest? Well, there's meditation, there's yoga, there's deep breathing, there's prayer, and this is what changes the immune genes and gives us more energy and insulin secretion.
Well, that's right. So in this study, they analyzed 22,000 genes, okay, before they looked at a short-term study that was just 8 weeks long using this relaxation response, and what they found were the things that we just talked about. They also found that mitochondria, which are the little energy packets in our cells that make ATP, which is the energy the cells run on, gas runs a car, ATP runs your cells, and they found that it made more ATP, it decreased inflammation, stress, the effects of trauma, of
blood pressure, anxiety,
of getting cancer, and of course it boosted insulin sensitivity. So we're looking at things here that are simple, that do big things. You know, this is Bruce Lipton's work, where he's talking about epigenetics. Genetics is what DNA and genes do. Epigenetics is far more important than DNA, because it regulates how DNA works. DNA is just there. Our genes are just fixed. But what triggers them to do what they do depends on the stimulation that they get from the environment. So it's toxic exposures, it's stress, it's lack of sleep, it's what you weigh, it's how much exercise you do or don't do, and whether or not you're feeling good about who you are. These things regulate how your body works and actually determine how we're going to be functioning in our lives in a very important way.
Well, this is part of living a healthy lifestyle. We always add stress reduction. So this is a great way to reduce your stress levels, because it seems that if you practice this on a regular basis, that it has the long-term benefit.
Well, that's right. I mean, we have to remember that we're not just stuck with our genes. If you look at people who were alive and 50 years old 100 years ago, they actually lived a better quality of life than we do today if we're 50 years old. Because what happens is, I mean, they weren't poisoned by the thousands of environmental toxins that we created.
And you don't need to go to an oxygen bar, because
that's the silliest thing I've ever heard of.
This increases your oxygen consumption to do this. When think about it, if a person's anxious and they're hyperventilating, they're not getting enough oxygen.
Well, they're getting plenty of oxygen if they hyperventilate, but it's not the way to go to get it, because it gets your whole stress reaction going. So you're right. That's a big thing. So when we're talking about lifestyle, you're talking about the most powerful medicine that there is in the universe. And it's what we should be focusing on more than what we're doing in regular medicine.
And this is why we bring it up almost every show.
Well, in every show. I can't imagine a show we've ever done where we don't talk about the importance of lifestyle. Because if you don't have a healthy lifestyle, that's when you're going to need a doctor. And if our doctors could shift around and work with the naturopaths or become naturopaths themselves, it would be nice to see that blend occur. And as I said earlier in the show, I would love to see naturopaths be in the hospital helping people to do the best that they can nutritionally and in terms of meditation and all the things that they're expert in that are related to a healthy lifestyle. We can't go on doing the things that we do and think that we're going to be able to stay healthy. Our disease care system costs too much money. It doesn't work very well. When 50% of the population has a chronic illness, I mean, that's an outrageously high number, and it's an admission that we failed. And it's because we don't focus on that. We're more apt to listen to some direct-to-consumer ad that tells you about some product that you could consume if you have a certain disease. And then you listen to the side effects of what they talk about, and it's like, my God, I don't know whether the side effects are worse than the disease.
Well, this is probably one of the reasons, like we started out with the show, that we're 37th in the world.
Well, that's right. And we got a long way to go. As long as we're stuck on a system that's based on return on investment, as long as dollars are the leader, we're in trouble. We got to start taking responsibility ourselves. That's where we lose out. We forget that we're in control of our health if we'll just step up to the plate and live our lives in a healthy way.
Well, it's not easy for a lot of people because there's so many temptations that are unhealthy.
Well, and they don't believe it, really. If you talk to people in the street about lifestyle and how important it is in their health, they're going to be saying, well, there are drugs to do this. I need some doctor who's going to help me with my symptoms.
Or they might pay attention after they get sick.
Maybe, but then often it's too late. I mean, you have to lose about 50% of the function of an organ before it starts to fail. And once it fails, it's school's out. I mean, you're in trouble. And then you can't really make it up. And the drugs don't make up for tissue that's gone. So we need to change that and start doing the kinds of things that we need to do to take responsibility ourselves.
So we hope that something that we've said will motivate you.
Well, I would hope that would.
To take care of yourself and to live a healthy lifestyle, because nobody else is going to do it for you.
Well, healthcare reform is about what you do to reform your own health, because it's not going to come from the government. It's not going to come from the top down. It's going to come from the bottom up. It's not going to be through legislation. It's going to be through inspiration. All right, we're at the end of the show, and we want to remind you that we'll be back to talk about what's new in the news in health the first and third Mondays of every month on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on PRN.FM.
If you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio and DrSaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Have a great week, and we'll see you next time.